Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back as my guest today, David Baldacci. We'll be discussing Mr. Baldacci's new novel, Divine Justice, which has just hit number one on the bestseller list. And first of all, David, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today.
It's always great to be back.
And this is the fifth time we've talked, and this is the first time we talked in 05. We discussed the Camel Club, and I know you had a great time writing that. And talk a little bit about Divine Justice and how Oliver Stone has evolved, and how much you've enjoyed writing the series.
Well, you know, after Stone Cold, which was the last installment of the Camel Club last year, I left a literal cliffhanger where people didn't know whether Oliver Stone was going to make it or not. And at that point, I wasn't really sure I was going to bring him back. I thought, should I just let it end that way, be a little bit ambiguous? But I really wanted to revisit those characters again, and so I resurrected him. He came out of the Chesapeake Bay alive, and now he has to go on the run because he's killed two very prominent government officials who really destroyed his family many years ago, and he just wants to try to lose himself, go south, and try to build a new life. But because if something happens in the novel, he ends up in a little Appalachian coal mining town called Divine, Virginia, in southwest Virginia, and if he was looking for some peace and quiet there, he didn't find any.
No, he didn't. And you know, David, as I was reading the book, I was thinking, this really is a novel about personal integrity.
Yes, it is.
And if you would talk a little bit about the integrity of Oliver Stone and some of the people that we don't know whether their motives are pure or evil along the way, but I really liked the way you dealt with integrity in this book.
You know, Stone, even though early in his career he was in the Army, then he worked at the CIA, and he was basically a government assassin, he's the sort of guy that if you were in trouble, he would be there for you. He's about as loyal a person as you're ever going to meet, reliable and courageous, and he really is willing to sacrifice his life for the people he cares about. He ends up in this small town and is confronted with problems that have nothing to do with him at all, but there are some good people in this town and some bad people, and he decides that he needs to help people. I think it's really just in his nature. I'm not sure if he does it to try to make up for the things that he'd done early on in his life, but it really is a part of who he is to try to help people. And I love the gray areas. I don't, you know, the world is not black and white. I don't write any characters who are all good or all evil. I write characters who are flawed and who make mistakes along the way. Sometimes good people do bad things. Sometimes bad people can do something that seems redemptive in a way. And those are the sort of characters I like to write about, and this book is filled with them. Everybody from Joe Knox, who's a guy from CIA who is tasked to hunt Oliver Stone down, and he probably has the most dynamic character evolution in the book, where he goes from seeing this is just another job, bring the guy in, he's a bad guy, I really don't care anymore about him. But the more he learns about Oliver Stone and learns that he is a guy of integrity, he is a guy who has lost a lot in his life and who is basically a lot of injustice was done against him, he starts thinking very differently about Oliver Stone by the time he actually catches up to him.
Okay. And on page 80, you write that one of the things I like about Divine Justice as well is I think a lot of people think of the intelligence business as being a glamorous profession. And in Divine Justice, you really kind of get a sense of the mundane and the day-to-day operations, that it's not all, you know, like you see up on the silver screen.
No, it's not at all. You know, a lot of it is very tedious work, much like investigative work is tedious work. The character Joe Knox spends a lot of time talking to people, going through dirt, musty old records, trying to track down leads. It's not jumping in a jet and, you know, sipping champagne and falling into bed with beautiful women. That's just not the way it works. It's
mm-hmm.
often a very dirty business, and sometimes you have to get down in the trenches as much as the other side does if you want to accomplish your goals. And it takes a very special sort of person to do it, a lot of personal sacrifice. You're away from your family, away from your home, away from your country for long periods of time. And there aren't a lot of people that can do the sort of job that needs to be done by these people.
Mm-hmm. And you do, I think, a very good job of writing about women in the intelligence field as well. And I think that's something that's overlooked in a lot of political novels, is the importance of women and the roles they play in solving these dilemmas.
Well, you know, my personal take is that I don't write about damsels in distress because I don't happen to know any personally.
Right.
And the women that I write about are the women that I know. They're strong, they're independent, they multitask, they can, in many ways, they're far more efficient and better at things than men are. And that's a sort of way that I write them. But given that, they, you know, there are also flaws and problems and issues and personal problems that you have to deal with, that anybody else would have to deal with. And that's my driving goal, is to make the characters feel real to the reader. And by making them feel real, you have to sort of give them, you know, typical human issues and problems. At the same time, they're sort of going through this sort of exciting, you know, thriller novel.
Yeah, and I hope you take this in the spirit as intended, because it's a huge compliment. There were times, as when I was reading Divine Justice, published by Grand Central, that I thought a little bit of Travis McGee.
Yes.
And I don't know, since the last time you and I've talked, I've moved to Orlando, Florida, and I'm teaching English in high school now, and so I'm in the Florida area, and I thought of Travis McGee during the book, and we're not going to give anything away, but there were times when I thought of Travis very fondly as I was reading Divine Justice.
That is a big compliment. I take it as a great compliment. And I, you know, there is sort of that kind of that, you know, dogged determination and nuts and bolts and back to basics and following up leads and hunting things down and just being, you know, just tenacious. And that, those are all good ingredients. And at the same time, never really knowing what's, you know, you're going to open a door. You don't know what's going to come through that door, but trying to be as prepared for it as you can. And at the same time, having sort of all these inner conflicts about what your motivation really is supposed to be, and the people you're looking for, one thing, but you have to watch your back the whole time, too.
And you're listening to the Casey Coar Show, a celebration of words. My guest today is David Baldacci. We're discussing Divine Justice. And, David, one of the topics that you write about very eloquently in this book is the abuse of prescription drugs, and really the epidemic that has taken place. And did that have anything to do where you set this novel in terms of, I mean, I know it's a nationwide problem, but it seems in Appalachia, some of those areas, to be a particularly bad problem.
Yeah, it is. My mother's family's from that area. I had two uncles who were coal miners. I've been in coal mining country as a youngster, and as a teenager, as an adult. And, you know, I've seen the devastation it can wreak on a community. Not just, you know, the drugs are an epidemic, and they're an enormous problem, and they cause all the sort of problems you would expect drugs to do. High crime, broken families, lost jobs, and all that. And at the same time, you look at the environmental issues that coal mining causes, where sometimes they don't drill into the mine, they just blow the mountains up, and it changes topography, changes rivers, towns are lost. So it really is. We depend on all this to keep the lights on, but I don't think many Americans realize that the huge personal cost and sacrifice that goes into that.
Absolutely.
And that's one reason I set it there. One, it allowed for a really interesting plot point and a plot twist in the novel. But at the same time, with all my books, I like to both entertain and inform, and I thought this would be something that other people would like to know about.
Sure, absolutely. And I found you always put some things in there. I like some of the nods to some great mystery writers, like I mentioned, John Dickinson Carr and some of the others, and I always enjoy that in your books. And then you always have a few things that I say, how did he find out about that? And like the intelligence rooms and stuff. It's just fascinating as a reader to because I know when I read your books, I know that there's an element of truth in anything you put in there.
Yeah, there is. I mean, particularly with the government. The government, and I found intelligence agencies, while you think that they would, you know, destroy things and not want to keep anything, I found that they sort of err on the other side. They keep everything. They keep it very well guarded and out of public sight, and are, you know, quite certain that nobody who shouldn't get it, you know, will be able to access that information. And a lot of money is spent doing this. As I said in the book, I said when you have a government, you have billions of dollars to spend, you don't go out and rent storage space at a typical, you know, rental USA kind of place.
Right.
You build, you know, entire cities under crappy barns.
Exactly.
So yeah, that part was fascinating. Military history, how you can go and research, you know, soldiers' history at various facilities.
Yes.
And it really allowed you, one, to see how that works, and also allowed me to develop Joe Knox's character along the way and show you what kind of a guy he was.
Yeah. Now, David, what are you happiest about with Divine Justice now? I mean, obviously, this is kind of the more enjoyable part now. You get to see the success of the book. People are reading it and discussing it. What are you happiest about with Divine Justice outside of the fact that this baby you created a few years ago, the Camel Club, has become such a popular series and people eagerly anticipate, you know, the release of the next one? And I've got to say, I have to assume there are going to be more.
Well, you know, I'm out on book tour now and visited a lot of places. I've been in a lot of talks across the country and a lot of book signings, and it is overwhelming how people come up from all age groups, all walks of life, and how much they love these guys.
Yes.
They love the Camel Club members.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not your typical heroes, but I think that's one reason people find them so endearing. But I guess probably the best thing I like about it is over four books – I don't think I've fallen into formula at all. I think
no.
I expanded these characters, really dug into their lives, and showed you some new territory. And I've never let them get stale. I think they keep getting fresh with each book, and I like discovering, you know, what they have left inside them with each book, and then taking that in turn and allowing readers to see it. So I think that's probably what I feel best about, is that they really feel fresh coming out of the book each time.
Well, I mean, obviously Divine Justice is a winner, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And David, if you would, before I let you go, give us an update on Feeding Body and Mind. How is that going?
It's going great. At each of my book signings, we work with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks. And I collect books at my book signings, and then when the boxes are full, we pay to have them shipped to local area food banks. And over the course of about 3 years, we've collected hundreds of thousands of books across the country and sent them to food banks across the country. As you can imagine, food banks are inundated with people. They lost their jobs. They lost their homes. And, you know, we do a lot of work with literacy. We fund a lot of literacy
programs. I know you do. Thank you for that.
And it's imperative that, you know, we need to turn this around. You need food to survive, but you got to have high literacy skills to get good jobs and be self-sustaining. And I've sent out about 25 letters to my other author friends so that they, in turn, can join me on their book tours so we can, and, you know, instead of collecting hundreds of thousands of books, we can start collecting millions of books.
Yeah. Do you have anything going in Orlando yet?
Not yet, but we're trying to work with libraries and bookstore chains and publishers to try to make this sort of a national footprint.
Anybody
who wants to help us, they can go to wishyouwellfoundation.org and email us and let us know any ideas they have. We can expand the program. We really are looking to partner with a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations.
Well, I'd kind of like to carry the torch for you down here in Orlando on that, because it's a huge need, and I loved when you told me about that idea a year ago. I just loved it.
We'd love to work with you, Casey. We really would. It's a perfect program. It's simple, but it's highly effective.
Great. Well, we've been speaking today with David Baldacci. We've been discussing Divine Justice. David, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the graciousness of your time. Congratulations again on the success of Divine Justice. And as we always say, I'll catch up with you on the next one.
It sounds great. Always a pleasure.
Okay. Take care, David.
All right.
Okay.